Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to your program. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. Today, there will be no guest. I wanted to have more opportunity for you to be able to call in and offer your insights on some issues I'm going to raise. We share both health and nutrition, the latest on how we can live a longer life. Then we go to issues that are socially relevant today. I'm going to share some issues on let's re-examine anarchy and compare that anarchy to what we all suffer from today, irrational fears. And what do we have in its place? We have organized fears. What do I mean? Almost all of our lives are controlled by some hierarchical despotism, someone who is telling us what to believe, what to think, and so we get in line. We believe that if someone has a larger bank account, more prominent position within a society, is more degreed, that we should defer to that person. Why? We'll talk about that. These are some thoughts that were raised by Dmitry Orlov. I will then share a short issue segment from Macro Business on growth, the false god. Now, why is this important? Because virtually everything you're going to hear in the media, everything is based upon we must get back to where we were. We must increase our gross domestic product with more jobs and... No, we shouldn't. I believe that that is why we're in such a deep mess today. What is the alternative? I'll offer that up and I'll ask you to offer yours after I give that commentary. Then I'm going to share my own commentary that I've written yesterday while traveling and filming on why are so many of our children being diagnosed as mentally ill. And if we're not watching carefully, within another 2 to 5 years, virtually all children in the United States, including infants, babies, will be forced to undergo some form of mental health screening program. And you can bet that the criteria for mental illness will be so broad, so all-inclusive, there won't be a kid left that won't be diagnosed and then put on drugs, of course, for their own good. Just what we want, a nation of 3-month-old babies on Prozac. Now you're thinking, Gary, that's not possible. We have over 800,000 physicians and nurses. They wouldn't allow that. No, they are the problem. They're not only allowing it, they're encouraging it. What happened to decency, ethics? What happened to anything resembling honest healing in the medical profession? It's not there. So I intend to offer a challenge to the entire fraud of our public health system, from the Surgeon General and virtually all governmental agencies and virtually all governmental programs. They're all fraudulent. They do not help us. They hurt us. Also, that people in the pharmaceutical industry who are master manipulators can make it seem like every single thing you think they've got a diagnosis for. You're nothing more than a profit stream for them. I will share my comments along with Evelyn Pringle and Martha Rosenberg. And if time permits, and I don't know it will, how did we get there? Well, we got there because we allow only one group of people in America to tell us what is normal behavior. The priesthood of the mind. The psychopharmacist, wet dream. Psychiatrist. No science. No ethics. Complete fraud. And that's how they get there. So I'll deal with that as well. You might want to let people know what's coming. From our environmental segment today, I'm going to examine several issues, including fracking is poisoning families at an alarming rate. I'll give you the latest on that. Finally, a court has ruled that mobile phones do cause brain tumors, and I'll give you the scientific opinions on that. And let us begin. We all know that we need a good night's sleep, not just occasionally, but all the time. What happens if you don't have a good night's sleep? Well, several things occur. First, you're not going to have a strong immune system because part of your immunity is created during sleep with melatonin. That is a very important hormone secreted from the pineal gland that protects your brain, but it also goes throughout your entire blood system and therefore goes to your cells, so it's very important we have melatonin. Also, in the deepest part of sleep, we are able to get restorative and recuperative energy back, and without it, we don't. If you wake up and you fall asleep and you wake up and you fall asleep, then you're breaking that cycle. So your immune system is more compromised. You're more likely to have infections. And then you don't have regular secretion of energy. Because without proper sleep, your circadian rhythms get out of balance. They're not calibrated. And so we're tired throughout the day. And we also don't have the right mental acuity. We're not really sharp mentally. How many times have school teachers have seen their students nodding off, not because the class is boring necessarily, but because they didn't get a good night's sleep? So this is the latest on why we need a good night's sleep. This is from the University of Chicago medical researchers, and here's what it says. Lack of sleep can disrupt metabolism in the body. I'll quote this. The function of sleep is not just to give rest to the brain, but also, even our fat cells need sleep to function properly. Now, here's what it does. This article explains how they found that not getting enough sleep has a harmful effect on your fat cells, reducing by 30% their ability to respond to insulin. And we know that that's crucial because insulin is the hormone that regulates energy. So sleep deprivation has long been associated with impaired brain function, causing decreased alertness and reduced cognitive ability. But now we realize it could be leading us to weight gain and diabetes. Quote, we found that fat cells need sleep to function, said Dr. Brady, professor of medicine, vice chair of the Committee on Molecular Metabolism and Nutrition at the University of Chicago. Quote, many people think of fat as a problem, but it serves a vital function. Body fat, also known as adipose tissue, stores and releases energy. In storage mode, fat cells remove fatty acids and lipids from the circulation where they can damage other tissues. When fat cells cannot respond efficiently and effectively to insulin, these lipids leach out into circulation, leading to serious complication. So, one more reason not to eat within 3 hours going to bed, not to have any lights on in the room at all, not to sleep within 6 feet of a television or a digital clock, and certainly don't be holding any cell phones or looking at a computer, because if you are on a computer and then you go to bed, the electromagnetic pulses from the computer can disrupt the circadian rhythms and adversely affect chromosomes in the brain. So, don't be using the computer up close, because it'll affect you. Now, something that is really good for you is exercise. Now, according to the American Physiological Society, they found that exercise can help stimulate the T cells in our body, and that helps people, especially cancer survivors, especially if they've had chemo. So, the more exercise you do, based on this study, the more likely you are to survive. And that's important because historically people who've had chemo are too nauseated and too weak to exercise. So then not only is that not good for them, it actually doubles down as a negative. I'm surprised over the last few years, and accelerating now, how many calls I receive of people who say, my son or daughter's had a stroke, and we'd like for you to talk with them. Now, historically, that almost never happened. Now it is. And so I find out, and once I go through their lifestyle and their diet and their stress levels and everything else that can contribute to a stroke, The one thing no one, I mean not a single person that sees me, knows about is homocysteine, fibrinogen, C-reactive protein, LDL cholesterol, and triglycerides. These are the primary markers that if they're elevated, and you won't know it, you can't feel it, they can be 100 to 300% more likely adverse event happening if you don't get them down. Now, it's not difficult to get them down. I mean, if you have elevated homocysteine, if you took trimethylglycine, 500 milligrams, and 300 or 400 milligrams of B6, and folic acid, and B12, and trimethylglycine, you can get them down in a safe way. That's assuming you know that they're elevated. Historically, we've always assumed that until you get into your 40s or 50s, you're not really at risk of anything. Now we realize you absolutely are. This is from the current issue of Neurology, the peer-reviewed journal, done by researchers, University of Cincinnati College of Medicine in Ohio. Quote, more younger adults are suffering strokes. Now, researchers who examine the evidence of stroke in a large U.S. population suggest that they are becoming more common in younger adults. And the question is, why? It's not because they're getting an increased use of MRI scans or better diagnosis. It's just that it's the lifestyle. And just take a look. And we're talking about people who historically would never have been in an age group. For example, African Americans from 20 years old, that's young, to 54, the stroke rate went up from 83 strokes per 100,000 to 128 strokes. And it just keeps getting more and more. So what do we do about it? What's the good takeaway message from this? Well, first and foremost, I believe that if you've had the average American diet, hot dogs, french fries, pizzas, hamburgers, shakes, soft drinks, if you've been primarily sedentary, if you haven't taken your supplements, if you've been excessively stressed, then you should have a full inflammatory and basic blood chemistry, what's called a SMAC24 blood workup. If you're not elevated, that's good. If you are elevated, you can go to see a holistic dietitian or nutritionist or physician or nurse and get those blood chemistries down. We now have some new research coming out of South Korea where they've been able to use magnetic fields to have cancer cells self-destruct. What happens is the body removes old, defective, and infected cells through the process of programmed cell death, or what is called apoptosis. And in this, the process, the rejected cells responds to certain signals sent by the body by fragmenting, and immune cells then consume these fragments, what is called phagocytosis. Almost visualize a little Pac-Man going through and gobbling up this debris. Well, the magnets help trigger the programmed cell death of cancer cells. Doesn't impact good cells, but sure does cancer cells. And that's terrific. There's a professor at Cheon at Yonsei University in Seoul, and a whole team of scientists conducted experiments with bowel cancer cells using magnetic fields to induce programmed cell death. And they attached iron nanoparticles to antibodies which bind to receptor molecules on tumor cells. These molecules cluster when the magnet field is applied and triggering the self-destructive signal, and therefore programmed cell death. So that's good news. And that was published in the journal Nature Materials. Research shows that yogurt may be a natural blood pressure reducer. Now, thinking of all the people that eat yogurt for whatever reason, maybe they want to lose weight, counting calories, or maybe doing it because they want some good probiotics. By the way, the probiotic thing in yogurt is way overstated. That would be like trying to get your green tea from one of the green tea drinks on the market. You might get 5 to 50 milligrams. If you really want to get green tea at a level that's going to help you, it's generally 200 to 1,000 milligrams of decaffeinated green tea. Getting the probiotics out of yogurt, you're much better off getting the probiotic in a capsule, maybe 4 to 8 billion, and taking it that way. That would be like a case of yogurt. But there's another reason here, and that's the blood pressure. And this was a study from the American Heart Association's high blood pressure research session. And what they found was that eating yogurt on a long-term basis acts as a natural blood pressure reducer and can help reduce the risk of developing high blood pressure later in life. This was on 2,000 volunteers followed for 15 years. So that's good. And also new information and really important study from the peer-reviewed journal Clinical Nutrition shows that increasing the antioxidant levels, you know, like vitamin C and vitamin E and tocotrienols and zinc, coenzyme Q10, that is linked to less inflammation. And in one study, people who had hip replaced, when they had the antioxidants, they had far less inflammation. And a lot of people who, especially older people who have hip replacement, end up getting these blood infections, and then they get these interleukin-6 and tumor necrosis factor alpha increases. These are markers of inflammation, and that's bad because people can die from that. So when they took the antioxidants lowered these levels, and that's good. So lutein and lycopene and vitamin C and vitamin E, they help turn down inflammation in the body, and that protects you and allows you to live a longer life. So that's all good. And finally, another good reason to use the omega-3 fatty acids. This is from the Journal of Nutrition, and it says the omega-3 supplementation is accepted now and proven for depression in the elderly. And that's important because it will reduce the symptoms of depression in elderly people, according to the study. This is in a nutrition journal. So if you have depression and you are over the age of 60, according to this University of Milan study, you could be helped with about 2.5 grams to 3 grams per day. That's not a whole lot and easy to obtain, and it's inexpensive. So one more reason to use it. One last quick thing. I know a lot of you are probably frustrated because you have friends or family, as I have, that smoke. And you try to get them to stop and you explain the reasons why, and they look at you and say, mind your own business. And they have every right to do that. Our frustration is seeing the people we love and cherish know that they're going to get sick, but be living in denial. So what can we do if they're not going to stop smoking? Well, according to some research at Yale and the National Institutes of Health, quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. Now, you've heard me mention quercetin. It's the wonderful nutrient found in fruits and vegetables. And what it does, it can change the expression of genetic material in the lung of smokers and hence reduce the risk of lung cancer. That's so important. This is in Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention, the peer-reviewed journal. Here's what it says, quote, "Our findings provide suggestive insights into a possible mechanism to explain the inverse association between quercetin-rich food consumption and lung cancer risk observed in epidemiological studies," end quote. Well, how about apples and onions? Hey, they both are rich in quercetin. So if you have apple juice with celery, tastes good, very nice sweet taste, so it's not objectionable at all. Give that to someone who smokes. And give them onions, any way they like them. The more onions they eat, the better it is. In fact, an onion a day can help keep a stroke away because it is phenomenal in its ability to thin the blood. One researcher, separate from this, University of Utah, showed that 700 milligrams of quercetin led to significant reductions in blood pressure. The study was to be the first to report the blood pressure-lowering activity of this flavanol, and it was published in the Journal of Nutrition. And then the newest study that I have, and there's lots of them out there, but this just one at random, showed a reduction in cancer risk. So let me give you this quote. To our knowledge, the present study is the only investigative examining the association between dietary quercetin at a habitual consumption level and microRNA expression in lung tissue. That's cancer. So your onions, grapes, all good for you. You're going to live a longer life. And especially if you have someone who is not going to give up a bad habit, then help them do something that will minimize the disease process. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Oh, she didn't bat an eye as I packed my bags to leave. I thought she would start to cry. I sit around my room. You're the girl. She fooled me this time. She acted like I was the last thing on her mind. I would like to start all over again. Baby, can I change my mind?
I just welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Today, baby, no guest. I'm going to go to two short insight pieces. These are my pieces where I ask the audience for your feedback on this. Let me mention that tonight at 7 p.m. on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we're going to have a full panel talking about nuclear power and what we're facing in the future of existing power plants and what we can do to close them down. Kevin Kemps, a specialist in radioactive waste storage and nuclear facility operations for Beyond Nuclear, is there. Dr. Jeanette Sherman, a specialist in internal medicine, toxicology. She's worked in radiation and biological research, University of California nuclear facility, and as at the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory at Hunters Point in San Francisco. She also served as on the advisory board of the EPA's Toxic Substance Control Act and also an advisor to the National Cancer Institute. She's published 70 peer-reviewed journals, and she says that thousands of Americans have died because of Fukushima. And then Professor Carl Grossman will be on. He's from SUNY at Long Island, and he is one of the brightest minds we have concerning power plants. We're going to tell you what your government doesn't tell you about the dangers of nuclear power. So for those listening on our sister station PFW in Washington, please pay attention. And as well as all the other stations. That's tonight, 7 p.m., over the Internet. From our environmental segment now, scientists are finding significantly adverse effects when you have CO2 and your capacity for making decisions. Now, let me quote this in Medical News. Overturning decades of conventional wisdom, researchers at the Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, that's out of Berkeley, have found that moderately high indoor concentrations of carbon dioxide, that's CO2, can significantly impair people's decision-making performance. And that really surprised me because we've been told for decades, don't worry, your schools, your work office spaces, your home, any place where you might have high occupant density, not a problem. Wrong. It is a problem. Quote, in our field, we have always had a dogma that CO2 itself, at the levels we find in buildings, is just not important and doesn't have any direct impacts on people. This according to Dr. Fisk, author of the study from the Environmental Health Perspectives. So these results, which were quite unambiguous, were surprising. And it showed that it does make an impact. So once again, what we've been telling you for a long time, potted plants, hanging ivies, that's good for the air. Air filters, that's better for the air. opening windows and allowing circulation in these non-window circulating buildings where the windows are there but they never open, and in your homes also very important. When you're in a car, now right now in Washington, D.C., in the District of Columbia, in New York City, Los Angeles, in South Beach, all the places where you hear this program, they're cab drivers, and they're almost always leaving the windows up. My suggestion, get a little portable in-cab air filtration system. You can plug it right into your cigarette lighter, and then leave the windows down. That way you reduce a lot of this pollution. So we just have an awful lot of pollution inside of closed quarters, and that's bad for us. Also, what's bad for us are cell phones. This is the latest. Finally, the Italy Supreme Court in Rome has blamed officially cell phone for causing a illness leading to brain abnormalities, and that's good. Also, additional articles now show, quote, brain tumor pandemic. And another article shows, quote, a 500% increase in brain cancer risk with cell phones. And two of the people who spoke on behalf of the court here to give their expertise was a neurosurgeon, Dr. Gillespie Grasso, and also a professor of environmental mutagenesis, Angelo Levis. And they said, yes, that cell phones or cordless phones damage cells, making tumors more likely. So the industry, of course, is going to tell you no, because they designed and paid for the studies, but we know their studies are about as objective as the GMO studies done by Monsanto and DuPont. Don't believe them. Cell phones cause cells to heat up, and that can cause inflammation, and that is bad for you. And finally, from our environmental segment, hydrofracking on college campuses in Pennsylvania, believe it or not, your governor has signed into law what is just the perfect opportunity for the gas hydrofracking companies. They can actually put wells and hydrofrack on college campuses. I read the actual wording, so there was no misinterpretation. And they believe it's safe. Well, here's what they should know. They should just read what we have on our site, which is hundreds of articles on this. Fracking is poisoning families at a very high level. This is from Common Dreams. Quote, residents living near gas fracking sites suffer an increasingly high rate of health problems now linked to pollution and pollutants used in the gas extraction process. According to a new report conducted by Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project, when they looked at 108 Pennsylvania residents in 14 counties, and they did water and air tests, the results showed that 70% of all the participants reported an increase in throat irritations, roughly 80% suffer from sinus problems after natural gas extraction companies moved to their areas. And, quote, we use water for nothing other than flushing the commode, said Janet McIntyre, referring to the now toxic levels of water on her land, which neighbors a fracking site. McIntyre said her entire family, including their pets, suffered from a wide range of health problems, including projectile vomiting, skin rashes, indicative of family symptoms in the area, and every one of the households in that area said either the pets or livestock were suffering seizures, losing hair, suddenly falling ill, dying after and only after the gas hydrofracking. So they took water samples and soil samples, and here are all these chemicals in there. They're very volatile. They're petroleum hydrocarbons. Very bad for you. One more reason that we should double down in telling the governor no gas hydrofracking anywhere in New York State. And for the others who are listening from your states, I suggest you do the same. Now to our issue segment of our program. And at this point, I'm just going to give you two. One is the concept that we must always increase growth. Bigger the better. In fact, one of the things that happened with the TARP program that was supposed to help people's homes from being foreclosed on and small businesses from going broke, none of which was given to either of those. It was all given to major banks and companies and hedge funds, and they immediately went out and bought other companies. And sometimes when a company can't be innovative as itself, it will buy a small innovative company. It looks good on the books. Now they own it. So I'm opposed to this idea that we are going to be healthier in the future by growing our economy, because the reality is, how do you grow your economy? Well, right now, you have to grow your economy by showing you're profitable. All right, so how do you get more profitable? If the average American, if 70% of our total gross domestic product comes from consumer spending and consumers don't have the same amount of money they had before, you have 200 million consumers just don't have disposable income as they once had. They don't even have savings anymore. They're deeply in debt. Their mortgages are crippling them because the equity in their house is below the cost of their mortgage. They'll never get out of that. Plus, they have student debt, and frequently the parents have the student debt of their kids because they had to co-sign on the notes, so they're held accountable. So we take people knowing full well that they're not protected. We can bring in, under special visa programs, and we have over 8 million, highly trained, very motivated people who work for far less than American. And then we take factories, 36 a day, we close them down in the United States, more often than not, we outsource that to a country that is willing, through our trade agreements, to create cheap labor, abundant cheap labor. You know, they'll work for 14 cents an hour to a dollar an hour. Well, how are we going to compete with that? Well, you can't. So then you get the American worker who was making $75,000 a year and able to maintain a quality of life. Now they're working for $8 an hour. So that's how they make their profit. They eliminate employment, they downsize, and then they squeeze out profit from the workforce. That's the truth of how most companies are making their money today. And yet that makes them profitable, so their stockholders are happy, Wall Street's happy. And then we keep saying, well, we have to do more cutting. But what are they cutting? They're cutting the average person. Now, whereas past civilizations built their pyramids to gods who brought rain or made the rivers flow, in ours, we shop, right? The temple is the air-conditioned mall where we occasionally have lunch on small rolls of tuna and rice, which many Americans think is a tasty mix of the endangered and the engineered, before maxing out the credit cards for clothes they don't need to impress people they hate. Now, from the self-development books of Oprah and Tony Robbins to the world records in the Olympic Games, the act of standing still or of tomorrow not being better than yesterday is the ultimate sin. From computer processing speeds to pixels on phone cameras to waistline cues for the food buffet, everything must be faster, better, bigger. Achievement and victory, inculcated since school, themselves ranked against each other for parental selection, are the ultimate virtues. Now, nowhere is this obsession more apparent than in finance and economics. Governments are obsessed with GDP, gross domestic product, even if that means unsustainable debt, imbalances, or environmental destruction. Businesses are obsessed with profit growth, regardless of gross long-term merits. The CEO of any publicly listed company will be sacked quicker than you can say board meeting if he says otherwise. Investors, more to the point, are obsessed with beating inflation in each other. And of course, they are. They're investors. Despite living in probably the most comfortable country on earth, in what is probably the most advanced period in history, we are still unhappy campers. No mainstream politician, at least that I'm aware of, would dare to say growth is not the priority. And no mainstream economist would dare to say growth is the enemy. Tell your bank manager that you plan to earn less and you're likely to get a mortgage. Yes? No. Tell your financial planner that you want your assets to decline in value. Well, they'll probably refer you to a psychiatrist. Yet economics beyond growth is exactly what we need if some kind of equilibrium is to be restored in the domestic and global economy. Forgetting for the moment Malthusian arguments about resource scarcity, or indeed the science of climate change, for the insidious political economy of a highly unequal world to subside, and for the backbone of democracy and middle class, where most are in the middle, to reassert, we essentially need a no-growth environment. Now, what does that mean in lay language? It means, if you don't need it, don't buy it. Stop being a consumer. When you watch television, you're a consumer. Stop buying anything you see advertised. You're a program consumer. You don't need the newest car. You don't need all the gadgets. Tear up the credit cards. Boycott all box stores. Stop shopping in malls. Spend more quality time with your loved ones and your family and yourself. Stop using the weed killers. Stop using the pesticides. Take the time, a wonderful morning, to go to the farmer's market and speak with the local farmers who are bringing you fresh, organic, non-GMO produce. Shop in your local food co-op. They're ethical. They work as a community together. Support small little health food stores that have high-level integrity, not the big monolithic Whole Foods. Stop reading the Nation magazine's terrible propagandizing on behalf of Obama, and think about third-party candidates and the merits of what they bring if we would only pay attention to them. Look at the places that you spend your time and where you spend your money. That's how you get to a no growth, where you learn to become more sustainable, appreciate less, unclutter your life, and find joy and happiness in the things that are really important. And lastly, this is from Dmitry Orlov. And I want to quote this. It's not that long. It says, "When confronted with an increasingly despotic regime, the good people of almost any nation will cower in their homes, and once they are flushed out, will allow themselves to be herded like domestic animals. They will gladly take orders from whomever gives them, because their worst fear is not despotism, it is anarchy." Yes, anarchy. Are you afraid of anarchy? Or are you more afraid of hierarchy? Color me strange, but I'm much more afraid of being subjected to a chain of command than of anarchy, which is a lack of hierarchy. Now, mind you, this is not an irrational fear, but comes from a lifetime of studying nature, human, as well as the regular kind, and of working with hierarchical organizations, as well as some anarchistic organizations. The anarchy of organized ones work better. I've worked in a number of startup companies, which were quite anarchic in a good way, and were therefore able to invent and to innovate. I have also worked in a number of big established companies with many hierarchies of management and a laborious approval process for any new proposal. These companies couldn't invent or innovate worth a damn, and only continue to exist because the system favors big companies. When faced with the need to do something new, they always tried to buy a smaller, innovative company. This is because in a hierarchical organization, people who know more are inevitably forced to take orders from people who know less, and often know nothing at all beyond knowing how to get promoted. The result is that in hierarchical organizations, and I have seen this over and over again, the smart people sit around and do nothing, or as little as possible, because following stupid orders is a waste of time, while in the stupid people run around like chickens trying to get themselves promoted. Thus, I may be persuaded to accede to the specific and temporary authority of a superior at a given task, but I find it problematic to blindly accept the authority of my supervisor's opinion. It does happen that a competent person gets kicked upstairs into management. This has happened to the best of us, and it's even happened to me. But to keep climbing up the hierarchical ladder after that is to prove that that the promotion wasn't an error and that the person in question really is management material, i.e. a bit dumb, not particularly scrupulous, and very obedient. I am definitely not management material. I've seemed to be missing a gene that allows middle management types to automatically look up to their superiors and look down at their inferiors. I could never get past the thought that this hierarchy thing is all a big mistake. If anarchy works so well for the birds and the bees and the dolphins and the wildebeest, why can't it work for us? There are many things that deserve to be feared in the world, but a pleasantly, congenially, efficiently organized lack of hierarchy is definitely not one of them. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break, come back, and take your calls for the rest of our program.
It's your thing. Do what you want to do.
Have you with us? We're going to take your calls now. Let's say hello to Jonathan from Brooklyn. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Gary.
You're on. Your turn.
Hello, Gary.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I have to agree with you that the growth model is really a cancer model. And we can't keep doing it. We have to go to more sustainable models that where people have local groups and they get together. And they try to find ways of solving their own local problems. And that's really the way to go because going forward, if there is going to be some sort of anarchy, it's only the local groups, so getting together is going to be able to sustain whatever, just going to be resilient to be able to sustain whatever the changes are. If people aren't getting together, you know, like you said, the gangs will come in and they'll wipe everybody out. But if you have local groups that are strong and you have a local organization and you have a place where people can get together and pool their resources and actually build things locally and connect, like I said, with the farms and have some sort of sustainable model, you can have local groups building sustainability all over the place. And even if there's solar storms, we can weather it.
You're absolutely correct. I agree with that, and that's why I'm trying to encourage people to look at working together, the common we, rather than always the selfish I. And I believe that we, as a society, have enough independent thinkers who do not believe that someone who has a title or an upper management within a bureaucracy or a technocrat or bureaucrat is better able to solve the problems than we are. And that's why I believe that we will find through our crisis the strength to join together. Thank you very much. Mike from New Jersey. Hi, Mike. Your turn.
Gary, thank you for taking my call. Real briefly, I just wanted to mention the magic pill sort of syndrome that a lot of younger people are being influenced by, and my son is one of them, with Lance Armstrong in the news and a lot of performance-enhancing drugs. Last year, I found that he was taking bodybuilding drugs to get bigger. Now, we've cleaned him up of that, and he's good now. But a lot of his friends are doing it. A lot of kids are taking, as you know, stuff for ADD, and they get depressed. They get a drug for this, a pill for that, a pill for that. There seems to be a pill for everything, and it just seems to be almost a wave that we cannot overcome. And now it lands on in the news, and there's people who are almost saying that, you know, he had no choice but to do it because everybody was doing it. And I was wondering if you would just comment a little on that.
Well, then Lance Armstrong and Barack Obama are virtually identical, aren't they? They must
so.
Have came from the same mother, the same gene.
Yeah.
And they have the same group of apologists. He had to do it, and he was forced to. I guess they turned his arm behind his back. Now, when people make wrong choices, they almost always make these choices based upon a lack of character, not based upon a lack of understanding the consequences. When people rob a bank, they know there is a consequence. They just figure that the gun equalizes the people who do not have a gun, and in that moment they win that move. But life has many moves, and it's a transitional position. And so you have to ask, the hamburger I'm eating today, this cigarette I'm smoking today, the alcohol I'm drinking today, the money I'm stealing today, the person I'm manipulating today, will that come back at some point with a consequence? And the answer is yes, it always does. You just can't predict when. So why not just stop before you do something and ask yourself, what is the purpose of that?
Yeah,
wasn't it Alexander Solzhenitsyn who said, if one is forever cautious, one can remain a human being? And then when you look at the people who are willing to do anything to win, anything to get ahead, anything to get their moment of success, because we do not become critical of how people get successful, we just care that they become our heroes. So you see them in football players, baseball players, see them across the board in athletics. But it also means, now I've seen it too, I can't tell you how many races I've been in, and I saw someone cheating, and the other people saw too, and people chose not to say anything. So I go over to the guy, and I said, okay, so you won the award. What does it prove? So you won an award. So what? But we all know that you cheated. You would have our respect if you won the award and didn't cheat, and you would have our respect if you lost and you did the best you could. So as a competing athlete, and still a competing athlete, my rule is simple. Never take a shortcut that gives you an edge that everyone else shouldn't also be equal to. So if your training and your discipline in that training and your determination are what allows you, and your strength of will allows you to do better than you had before, then that is completely acceptable. Anything else that is allowing you an advantage that is not a fair and honest equation within the sport is not true athleticism. That is a lack of character. So working on the character of realizing it's not important that you win, it's only important that you tried the best you could using ethics and honor in the process. Okay? Thanks a lot for your call. Luann Panessi, your turn, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have a bunch of emails here today. I have something from a woman, doesn't say where she's from, but she listened in to your talkback show last night, and she says her husband is an electrical engineer, and they were talking after the show, and he said that that you remind him of Nikola Tesla. And she said, I don't know if anyone ever said that about you before. And she thought that, you know, since he was an inventor, he was a futurist, and he was, you know, he contributed to the design of the modern AC electrical supply system. She just felt that, I guess he felt that you were as, you know, progressive-minded and so ahead of the times. And she thought you might want to comment on that.
Tesla was a Serbian-American engineer. And he did far more for the world in understanding how we could use nature authentically and naturally with his alternating current, as opposed to Thomas Edison, who didn't believe in the alternating current. In fact, did everything he could within his capacity, even trying to get Congress to pass a law banning it. And of course, Edison had General Electric as a partner at one point, and he had J.P. Morgan as a partner, but so did Tesla at one point. Tesla was an eccentric, but he had something that was unique. Now, Edison had no formal education, and he was brilliant, but what I feel was his real brilliance is how he hired all the brightest people and all the brightest inventors to work for him. Nikola Tesla didn't do that. He came across his inventions by epiphanies. Suddenly there was a vision, and in the vision he would see something, and then he would write it down, he would sketch it out. I mean, in the 1800s, he was sketching out what we hadn't even invented yet, like airplanes or spaceships, and ways of powering all the grids and all the factories on the earth. He was the first person to actually invent a wireless communication where an electric magnetic pulse could send a signal and then you could hear this. He didn't get the credit for that, and that's unfortunate. The man who actually got the credit for that came to see Tesla, and this is one of those little unknown parts of history. And that man was Marconi. And Marconi, who was from Bologna, Italy, and he was bright. He had ideas, but he couldn't figure out how to apply that ideas to make it work. So he came to Tesla, and he went into his lab. And you know what Tesla did? He said, all my writings, all my research is open. I'm not interested in the money. And in fact, he wasn't interested in money. His partner, George Westinghouse of Westinghouse Electric, who himself was a brilliant man, not only gave him $1 million for his patents, but also gave him $1 per kilowatt, which was ended up being millions and millions of dollars. He would have been one of the wealthiest men in the world, certainly in the United States, had he capitalized on the commercial aspect of what he did. But he didn't want that. He was an ascetic. He was much as misunderstood because he wanted to spend time alone with his work and helping society. So in comes Marconi, goes in and spends time with him. And in effect, it was Nikola Tesla who gave Marconi all that he needed, and then going back and taking this information, and then he succeeded in sending the wireless signals over a distance of 1.5 miles, and then he became this greatly respected person, and he was granted the world's first patent for a system of wireless communication. And in fact, he founded, I think it was, what was it, the Wireless Telegraph and Signal Company. Later, in his own name, he was always very successful. And then he hired other people. He brought all these scientists together. And then once he had the money and once he had the fame, then other people came to work for him. He was the first to broadcast a microwave radio beacon from a ship navigation in 1935. Well, that same invention in 1904, Tesla had. In fact, he wanted J.P. Morgan to finance it, and Morgan didn't believe it was possible. But it was. So Tesla created the polyphase system of generating alternating current. And for a short time, he worked for the French branch of the Edison Company, and he worked in an electrical plant in Strasbourg, where he repaired stuff. And he was given a bet that he couldn't make a certain invention. And he was offered $50,000 if he could improve the DC motors. And he did. And it was acknowledged, yet Edison never gave him the money. And then he met this man named George Westinghouse, who owned Westinghouse's Pittsburgh Labs. And Westinghouse bought his patents and put him to work. And he was brilliant, but he was an eccentric. He didn't know how to speak with people. And so he was always creating. In my opinion, he is one of the three greatest scientists to ever live on the planet. And other scientists knew that, but his arch enemy, he didn't want to fight anyone. He was a complete pacifist, was Thomas Edison. And that was Edison's dark side. People don't realize Edison had a really dark side, but he did. In fact, he tore up and gave back Westinghouse the $10 million that he had earned up to that point when Westinghouse was running short on money. That's how ethical he was. J.P. Morgan financed him for a while. His lab was mysteriously burned down in New York and all of his notes lost. Then his lab in Colorado was burned down. He was out of Colorado Springs where he had a lab. And he ended up dying in absolute total poverty. Oh, by the way, one of the things he did, you know Niagara Falls, you know all the electricity that came off that, that's his, that he created.
Wow.
So we can thank all that. So there was no greater electrical engineer I know of in world history than him, Thomas Edison. Edison was bright, but Edison hired Louis Latimer, and Latimer was the one who actually created the filament for the incandescent light bulb, because Edison's bulb would only work 30 hours, then it would burn out. He had the wrong filament. And so when he showed his patent, Edison bought up his patents. Edison would buy up everyone's patents. Then he took credit for, I think, 1,069 patents. He never had 1,069 patents. He had ideas, and he got other scientists and other inventors and took credit for theirs and then owned them. But nobody could ever touch this great man. He died, I think, around 86 years of age. Hope that answers your question.
I understand he didn't sleep much either. There's another parallel right there.
No, I don't. Please, on no level am I comparing myself to him.
I know.
I'm just saying that he was a misunderstood person in his time, and most Americans are not aware of their history, and certainly not aware of the innovators who, today, the cell phone, all our cars, none of that would have been possible without him.
I understand he was also he was friends with Mark Twain as well.
He was very good friends with Mark Twain. And he was very good friends with a lot of the people at that time who themselves were innovators and respected other people who have innovative minds. We're out of time. Thank you. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Destination reed. I'm an ever spinning car, whirling.